Hello, this is Sean Kennedy. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Nursing, and I'm very pleased to be speaking today with Suzanne Morris-Burrow. Suzanne is a President and Chief Executive Officer of Burrow & Ross Consulting in Fountain Hills, Arizona, which is a firm that specializes in patient safety. Do I have that right, Suzanne?
That's correct.
Right. So Suzanne is the author of an article in the November issue called Coccidioidomycosis. Say that for me.
Coccidioidomycosis.
Coccidioidomycosis. And the article is on this fungal infection and is a great clinical article talking about the differential diagnosis for visitors to the Southwest. And we're going to talk a little bit about just how Suzanne got involved in exploring this topic, but also some of the implications for nurses. And it's not just for nurses in Arizona. So Suzanne, why don't we get started and tell us a little bit about how you got interested in coccidioidomycosis.
Valley fever is easier.
Valley fever, yes. Also known as valley fever.
We'll just call it valley fever for the audience.
Okay.
I first heard about valley fever back in the late 90s. I was a nurse manager in a hospital in Boston, and I was interviewing a nurse for a job. And she was a traveler coming back from Phoenix. She was originally from the Boston area, and she got extremely ill, and she told me that she had been chronically ill with this valley fever, and she was coming home to recuperate, and she was looking for a job in our critical care unit. And I recall her being extremely thin and having this hacking cough, almost like a tuberculosis. But she didn't look well. But I hadn't heard about valley fever before. I think it's probably coming from Boston. But my husband had told me that he had contracted valley fever back in the late 70s. He was from Iowa, and he was doing an internship at the Indian Health Service in Phoenix, Arizona, and he had ended up contracting it probably in his third month out here, and he had the erythema nodosum, and that's the one mm-hmm. with the rash and the pain in the lower extremities, but he said that it was so painful for him. He would go to work in the morning, but by afternoon he was just so extremely fatigued that he couldn't continue his day, and this went on for weeks to months. And he was a perfectly healthy young man, but he did come from Iowa. And unfortunately, in the 70s, he was not treated. There was treatment. The oral azoles were out at the time, but mm-hmm. a lot of the practitioners were just taking that, let's just wait and see, and it usually resolves on its own. But
This was when he was back in Iowa?
This is while he was in Phoenix, because he was doing a one-year internship mm-hmm. in Phoenix. So he had been ill for several months, but he managed to carry on with his work. But, you can see where this affects their quality of life and their lifestyle, and they do lose a lot of time at work. And mm-hmm. and then when I moved out here in 2000, I started talking to people about this valley fever because I was intrigued by it. And it was amazing how many people I talked to would say, oh, yeah, well, I have a brother or my husband or I have this one or that. And you think, it's probably more common than I thought. And then one of my husband's young associates, his family was coming out to visit him from Ohio, and his mom goes back to Ohio after visiting, and she comes down with the diagnosis of valley fever. I thought, well, this is quite interesting. So while I was getting my doctorate, I was in an epidemiology course, and I thought, maybe I'll just look for more evidence-based research on mm-hmm. this phenomenon, because I really didn't delve into it that much. But we had an assignment that was on clustering effect, and I thought, I think valley fever is probably a good one for clustering in Arizona. So I wrote this paper, and it was very interesting. The funny part is that my professor, who was an epidemiologist, really did not believe any of the things that I was writing about. He said, this can't possibly be because the incidence is so high, and I've never heard of anything like this before. So you think, if there's a professional and who's an epidemiologist that doesn't know about valley fever, how many others don't know? So while I was in my doctorate, I also took this part-time job as a case manager in one of the hospitals here in Arizona, and I was working. I was covering the critical care unit, and there was a 28-year-old third trimester total respiratory failure, 100% O2 on the vent.
Oh, my gosh.
She had chest tubes in. She had empyema. She was draining this horrible yuck from her lungs. She was rupturing, and they didn't test her for valley fever. And she was probably into her second week of her illness when I was just making, because I was on call, I wasn't continually there. And I'm looking at it, and now I just wrote this paper for school. And pregnant women in their third trimester to immediate postpartum are high risk for valley fever. She has all the symptoms, and here she is being treated for a bacterial infection. No one had tested her, and it really bothered me.
This was on people's radar.
Here I am in an endemic state in Maricopa County, which has the mm-hmm. highest incidence of valley fever. I'm in a hospital in a critical care unit, and they did not try to rule out valley fever. So that's when I really started mm-hmm. to get intrigued with why aren't people looking at this diagnosis? Why isn't that differential out there? It's not only in non-endemic states. It's even here mm-hmm. in Arizona. Because I had erroneously assumed that because Arizona had mandatory reporting, I interpret that as that being when you see a patient that comes in with what appears to be a community-acquired pneumonia, you're going to also test them for valley mm-hmm. fever to rule that out. That's not what it means. All it means is that when the labs receive a positive result, it's reported to the state,
right.
which goes on to the CDC. So they're having this issue with the practitioners in this endemic state are not testing the patients that are coming in with what appears to be a community-acquired, and then they're giving them the antimicrobials and,
right.
and antibacterials, and they're not getting the antifungals that they need. So
now, when was that?
Hmm?
When? What year was that?
This was last year.
Last year. Oh, my gosh.
This was last year.
Because the as your article points out, there's been the increase, I'm just looking at it right now, the number in cases increased from 1,400,
mm-hmm.
Say 1,475 in 1998, to 16,000. So, I mean,
and that's just what's reported, and
that's
what the problem is, because many of these patients are presenting in a primary care doctor's office, and the Valley Fever Center for Excellence it's just a wonderful resource. They're just coming out with so much data. But they had done a study, and they found, I think it was done in 2008, they found that only 3-13% of practitioners are ordering valley fever testing.
For these patients who have this community-acquired pneumonia symptoms and
acquired pneumonia. So now, they're estimating that 90% are going undetected.
Wow. That's and there's such consequences in terms of chronic and,
mm-hmm.
and the disseminated
mm-hmm.
Disease. So that's amazing that in an endemic state that this
mm-hmm.
is not on people's radar more.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things, while it's endemic, certainly Arizona, I think, has close to 70% of the cases in the U.S.,
yeah,
mm-hmm. but it's all those desert states, Arizona, California, New Mexico,
right.
Texas. Mm-hmm. But with as we were talking a little bit earlier, people come and visit and then leave back to
mm-hmm.
other areas where if it's not on people's radar in Arizona, I'm sure it's not on people's radar in New York and Boston and
exactly.
other places.
Exactly. And I think that's the audience that I'm trying to reach. Not only do I want to reach the nurses in Arizona and just remind them that this is going on and it's increasing, but also for those nurses that are taking care of the patients that do travel to Arizona at the time of year when we do have a higher incidence of valley fever, when we have our dust storms, when people are out vacationing and riding their four-wheelers or going on the Jeep tours and they're disrupting the soil, or it's extremely windy. We have these periods where the winds can be very high,
mm-hmm.
and it's blowing that dust, and you may not see it, but it's there. I mean, these
mm-hmm.
are very small organisms that you're not going to see, but we do have dust warnings. You watch the weather, and you don't go outside.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who's not from Arizona may not think anything of it. They just
mm-hmm.
may think, well, it's a dusty day. It's no different than a rainy day. But for someone like myself, having a guest come into town, we would not be going outside.
Mm-hmm.
We would be staying indoors. The windows would be closed.
And you mentioned the high risk of women, pregnant women in their
mm-hmm.
late trimester.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other people who would be at high risk?
People who have diabetes, immunocompromised, patients that have had transplants, actually they found that patients with renal transplants are 75% more prone to contracting, just because the disease itself, your immune system is what actually fights the infection, and if you're compromised in any way whatsoever, HIV, AIDS patients, patients who are on steroids,
those are basic, all those patients
and the elderly, just because those over 65, they're more fragile, their immune system might be compromised, and they have other comorbidities. And of course, being Arizona, a lot of our winter visitors are elderly. So, you know, that's a population that we really have to be careful with.
So for nurses, it's really for themselves keeping a kind of a high incidence of suspicion when somebody comes in with, especially if you're living in one of these states, if someone has a prolonged respiratory infection, but also for nurses who are outside that area as well, but also patient teaching in the sense of, you know, if somebody's going...
before they go.
Yeah, before they go, what to maybe wearing... Do masks help if somebody...
They haven't proven, that hasn't been quantified, that a mask does work, but I think a lot of... employers require, just for liability purposes, people who are out landscaping,
and
construction to wear masks during dusty season or if there's any disruption of soil. We do have a state law out here that if you are disrupting soil, you're supposed to be watering down the area. But unfortunately, we have a lot of horses out here, so there are horses. I lived in horse country where we had corrals surrounding our property, and when the horses would start running around, the dust would rise. So anybody who has horse property is also supposed to be watering down their corrals, but many people don't, and there really is no surveillance of that. So, you know, you have people that are going horseback riding when they're on vacation. They think this isn't that great. But also remember that horses are disrupting
the soil. And it's that top dusty. Couple of inches of soil where the spores live.
Right, right. And it's not everywhere, but you don't know where it is, and that's where you have to be careful. But you do know that there are certain areas in Arizona that have a higher incidence, like Maricopa has the highest incidence, so that would be the Phoenix, Scottsdale area.
And that's the prime area for a lot of
primary
visitors.
Vacationers.
Right.
And then Tucson, that area. So you're hitting two very popular vacation spots in the state.
Now,
outdoor activities.
Do most people who get this, and assuming somebody gets it and they went to a nurse who, of course, reads AJN and read your article, and the nurse said, you know, you might have this, you better get tested. So what's the likelihood in the sense of they have the disease, they test positive, and then they're started on antifungals? Do most people recover with no real effects, or do most people get complications or have issues?
You know, unfortunately, they have not proven, which is frightening in itself, they haven't proven that initiating antifungals reduces the duration of the illness or can prevent the complicated course. They're just hoping that it is. What they're focusing on now is getting an early diagnosis, getting treatment, informing the patient and letting them know what's wrong with them, because this overwhelming fatigue and just feeling rotten for weeks or months is frightening for so many patients. They just don't know what's wrong. So I think the most important thing is to get the diagnosis so at least you know what's wrong. Most patients think they either have TB or they have lung cancer. And when you have that type of a potential diagnosis over your head, it affects you mentally and emotionally. So they're thinking, at least if they know, and they know the progression of the disease, and they can know what to expect of this disease, they think that that's better. And then what you do is that you confirm it so that you don't have to look for any other disease. And based on the severity of their symptoms, that's when you decide whether you're going to start your antifungals or not. And the majority of these patients are going to be seen in a primary care setting. So, you know, you're going to get, your SED rate will be elevated. Your Y count isn't elevated, but your SED rate will be up. Your C-reactive protein will be up. And that's when you go, that's sort of a positive, but a negative does not indicate that you don't have it. So you test it, you know, two more times to see if it does bump. But the other thing is to check the IgGs and the IgMs. That's really the indicator, along with all the symptoms. So if you can test and see what their titer is, you know, anything above a 1 to 2 titer, is indicative of an infectious process, and the higher that ratio goes, the more severe, or if it changes, if the titer, mm-hmm. if it bumps up.
And is the chest X-rays, I mean, are they helpful? Or they tend to kind of just show that if there's an infiltrate, but not really what it is, I guess.
Yeah, it's not going to be definitive per se. I mean, mm-hmm. it will give you some guidance as a benchmark mm-hmm. of where they are at the initial stage of the disease. And a lot of times it is a unilateral process in the lungs. It's not bilateral infiltrates like you would see in a pneumonia, mm-hmm. a typical mm-hmm. pneumonia. So it may have some classifying features that are different from a community acquired. Mm-hmm. But it's most often used for monitoring the progression of the disease and the resolution.
Mm. Well,
and the key feature is that you have to make the correct diagnosis. You have to initiate the correct treatment, because you don't want to start them on antibiotics one or two cycles, because number one, you're reducing their resistance, and it affects the community the more antibiotics you put people on.
Sure.
And a lot of times people present with arthralgias, and people think that it's a rheumatoidal type of syndrome, so they'll put them on steroids, which again affects their immunity, mm-hmm. which could also...
Which probably exacerbates it, I would imagine.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And some are foolishly doing bronchoscopies, and they're doing fine needle biopsies, which they really don't need to do unless they are extremely ill. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a patient in a critical care unit. So it's just the simple management, understanding the signs and symptoms, making sure they don't have a complicated course, treating them appropriately, mm-hmm. educating them, and then monitoring them for up to 2 years following the diagnosis.
So why 2 years?
Because you can still have a complication up to 2 years following initial infection, mm. believe it or not.
Mm. Wow.
It's important to know not only that you had it, but that what you may possibly run into over the course of the next year or two.
I'm just amazed that we haven't heard more about this mm-hmm. disease, and that it has such a low profile because the ramifications of it are certainly long-lasting. They can be very complicated. Probably the only good thing is that it's not something that it's not a communicable disease to someone
That's
else.
That's about it.
That's
yep.
about the only good thing I
yeah.
can think of.
Yeah.
And does this, so if somebody has it, and then, for example, somebody living in Arizona in an area, are they more likely to get it again, or does it set them up to be more sensitive to repeated?
No, usually it's lifetime immunity, but, you know, there's a caveat there where, you know, take my husband, for instance, he had it in the 1970s when he was in his early 30s, but say when he hits 60s, 70s, he gets sick, he has a disease that he becomes immunocompromised, or he has cancer, something comes up, that's the time when you say, well, he could be reinfected. I mean, mm-hmm. that's when it can come back. You can have a relapse of valley fever, which I don't think people realize that either. So I'm looking at all my family, and I'm thinking, okay, of my family, who has had it, who do we need to look out for just in case they do have a diagnosis of mm-hmm. cancer, or they go on steroid therapy, or they become HIV positive. It's all right. this. It doesn't, even though you have this lifetime immunity, my perspective is that it's dormant.
Right.
It's immune, but it's dormant.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if something else arises later on in life, you still have to recall the fact that you were infected. And if they're not diagnosing these patients, even when they have a mild case, in the long run, in the end, over time, they may not be able to recall that diagnosis when they do have a relapse. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's something where it's good to have that diagnosis now so that later on in life you can say, well, maybe it's a relapse, mm-hmm. or maybe I need to be careful if I am immunocompromised.
Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for talking to us about this, and I hope people who have listened to this podcast will go read the article now, because certainly there's a compelling need to get this out there, especially now. It's October. Many of the people in the northern climates will be seeing patients who are taking trips to visit people in these areas that are endemic, where the disease is endemic. So this certainly is a good patient teaching point. And I just can't thank you enough for spending some time with us and for writing the article.
Thank you so much.